Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Hey, it's Christmas Eve. Yeah, you listen to this. Hopefully, day came out right around Christmas Eve. And I want to wish you Merry Christmas. And thank you for listening to the podcast. I want to say one of the things that I'm grateful for this holiday season, people like you who listen to the podcast, who supported the work, who've given me the opportunity to have the cool conversations I've been able to be a part of and the good stuff. So thank you. Let me tell you about something else I'm thankful for. Our friends at Come and See, the immersive surround sound audio treatment of the life and teachings of Jesus. Now, if you get this, you're going to be dropped into the middle of the story as one of Jesus' first followers. It's going to give you the opportunity to experience what it might have been like to actually follow Jesus when he was on earth. Now, the entire project is three volumes with a projected runtime of 6 to 8 hours. Now, the first three chapters of volume one are already available for download. Those who pre-order will receive access to all the chapters as they will be released. And you're going to get the only version of the life of Jesus that treats the listeners as a participant in the story, and the only version of the life of Jesus that includes every word and deed from the four Gospels with one overarching narrative. Now, my listeners will get a 25% discount by using the coupon code Luke. So go check it out at comeandseeaudio.com. Now, friends, on to our conversation with AJ Sherrill. Because it's almost time for the new year. In the new year, you want to start it off right. You want to rectify all wrongs of the last year. And so what we're doing on the podcast is, you know, I'm making some amends for something that happened just a few weeks before. I feel like this podcast gives us a great chance to let bygones be bygones and to move forward. Without further ado, Mr. AJ, actually, I think it's Dr. AJ Sherrill, the pastor of Mars Hill Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Here you go. All right, friends, welcome back to the show. Today we have joining us from Grand Rapids, Michigan, Mr. AJ Sherrill. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, glad to be here.
AJ, I feel like we have, I have some atoning to do. I need to make things right. There was something that I did wrong in the world, and I can only fix this by talking to you directly through Skype via the internet. Are you ready for me to do this?
Bring it on.
You and I were on the exact same flight from Jerusalem to, I believe, New York just a few weeks ago. And it was like a midnight flight, and I had been around people for a long time, and like I knew who you were. We were near each other, and I just didn't make the effort to say hi to you. And then Jonathan Merritt introduces us in an email, and I feel like this is God convicting me for being unhospitable. So I apologize.
I forgive you, and I'm gonna need to atone myself, because when I saw your picture, I remembered you in front of me. And here's what I thought. I looked at the way in which the fade in the back of your head was effortless. The way that the sort of short back sides blend into the long top of your hair. I remember seeing you and saying to my wife, weird as that sounds.
Okay, well, that makes me feel a little better.
So, even though I don't know why I would have told you that as a stranger, but well, I do remember seeing you.
Well, first of all, I feel like that's one of the best ways to begin a friendship is to acknowledge a good fade. And who knows what could have happened. But here's the thing. I made a fool of myself maybe a year or two ago in an airport, introducing myself to someone that I knew who they were, but like I didn't really have a real like, hey, I'm best friends with you kind of thing. I was in an airport, and I've got a friend named Paul. Paul is a Hillsong guy. I used to live in Sydney and lives in Gold Coast now. And I took a picture of this couple who is speaking Australian, which I know it's not a language, but you know what I'm talking about. And I say, hey, these must be Hillsong people because they sound like you. And he texts back and he goes, hey, that's actually, yeah, these are my friends. And it was Brooke Fraser and her husband. Mm-hmm. I forget their names. And new last name, I forget what it is. Anyway, and so my friend Paul says, don't be awkward. Go over there and say hi to him because, you know, I'm good friends with him or work with him or whatever. And I walk over and like I just have like this real awkward conversation. Like, oh, yeah, like I don't know why I'm talking to you. And I just didn't want to repeat that again in the airport. That's what it was. And hurt people hurt people. And I was hurt by my own foolishness before. I didn't want to do that again. And for that, I apologize.
I look forward to seeing you again at the airport and not talking.
Oh, can we do this for real?
Yeah, like, it's a thing now.
Okay, well then, all right, I'm good with that then. We'll just do awkward, like, head nods. How about that? You good with that?
Okay. I'll just acknowledge your fate.
All right, so you were over in Israel. You were not with the same trip I've been on, I was on, but you had been on that trip before. What were you doing this time?
So the last trip, the trip you went on with Telos, which I'd love to brag about because I just love that organization and the peacemaking efforts they're doing. That's more of a political, social, mm-hmm. current moment trip. This was more of a biblical, archaeological, historic trip.
Mm-hmm.
So one of Ray Vanderland's disciples curates a trip that he takes over there. And so this was sort of a different animal than the political one. So equally as life-giving and yet in such a different sort of tone as the one that you just went on.
What's the difference in tone? Like, what's the major difference?
Yeah, I think the heaviness of the political moment in Israel, Israel-Palestine, when you're there, is, it's the gravitas of that is more than the heart can bear.
Yeah.
The one biblically that you go on and spending time in the desert of Negev and on the Galilee at Bethsaida, I mean, that's just such a different animal of grappling with your historic story and Jesus of Nazareth. And so it just had a different weight where this one that I just came back from just brought like a joy and a levity and a longing, whereas the one is just heartbreaking and you sense of where's the hope and trying to reconcile those two stories, those two trips has been something that I've been really interested in is how does the past and the biblical hope of Israel intersect with the present and the political turmoil of Israel. So, it's been heavy, but different sorts of trips.
Yeah. And I think that's neat that there can be a place for both of those experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Todd does with the Telos trip is that there are some moments like that, but obviously the majority of it is the geopolitical crisis, which like you said, it's overwhelmingly heavy. But I did see on the Twitter that you have a peacemaking series starting in January at Marseille at the church you pastor.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk to me about your previous trip with Telos or?
No, we brought in Todd last year to do a little bit of that. This is sort of at Mars in the, how does the local church become a host for hopeful conversations on shalom? And so I'm bringing in just three friends of mine that are, I feel like, already making contributions mm-hmm. and that we can host maybe a larger conversation in West Michigan to resource this area of our country and the world. So
nice. Merritt's coming for that. Is that right?
And then he'll be here. He's doing a writer's workshop as well in the evening to help us just learn to write truthfully and gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa Sharon Harper,
yeah.
Will be here the next on the 13th. I believe that evening she's also going to do another session for our formation school. And then Rich Velotis, a really dear friend of mine from Queens at New Life, he's going to do the third week on sort of inward shalom. And then I'll wrap up the fourth week. And so I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm excited to be a part of that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Lisa's been on the podcast at least once, maybe twice. But I don't know, Rich, but sounds great. So you've been at Mars Hill for two or three years now? Just finished your second year. How's that been?
It's been really good. I think I've learned probably more in this environment than I have anywhere. And I'd come from New York, and I've lived in L.A. and Atlanta. And Grand Rapids, for me personally, has strangely been the hardest context to exegete. I found that New York and L.A. took me a lot less time to figure out sort of the flow and the ethos of the city. And Grand Rapids, it's in many ways under negotiation, as a lot of smaller cities are, as they're changing and growing and developing. So it's been a lot for me just to learn what this culture values and how the gospel intersects with who Grand Rapids is and who it's becoming.
Okay, tell me your quick take on what Grand Rapids values.
Yeah, it's a much more blue-collar town than other places I've lived. And so a primary value is working hard and working with your hands. Hmm. You know, New York, in many places, not all, but the place where I pastored it, which is called Chelsea, it's a neighborhood on the west side of the city. It's more of a white-collar vibe, ministering and being a part of communities like that, the gospel can take sort of a different sort of tone, and teaching, preaching, all of that is very different in that sort of environment. Here in Grand Rapids, the Shema spirituality of the intersection of hand, heart, and head, it has to happen in all of your teaching. Otherwise, it can come off as pedantic or just kind of intellectual. And people want to know, like, okay, great, Jesus is the Messiah. What does that mean for tomorrow? And what does that mean in the tool and die shop that I work in, or in my family at home with my four kids, which isn't normal in New York to have four kids in Chelsea. So it's just been very different for me and really, really life-giving and stretching in many ways.
How long did it take you to feel like you figured out New York and like what it meant for you to preach to people who live in that world and that environment? Coming from, was it LA to New York or is it LA, Atlanta, New York?
Yeah, LA, Atlanta, New York. Well, I had some really great friends there that running with helped me do that quickly. My friend John Tyson was really helpful to me and just giving me sort of some handles into that. So I think when you do that with people that are also doing ministry, it's easier. But I think it probably took me half a year in New York to really figure out where the dominant idols are, where the dominant sort of longings are, and how we can say no, what we should say no to, and what we need to step in and say yes to. Probably 6 months in New York.
Yeah. It's an underrated skill to be able to figure that out. Like, I found myself in the first 6 months, I remember making a joke one night about Episcopalians. And I was making this as someone who's, I'm good friends with many Episcopalians. I've got many Episcopalian priests who've obviously been on the podcast and who've been influences in my life. And so I make a joke as a friend making a joke about another friend. Like, I would make fun of my brother in the same way. And people from my church in our tradition have heard a lot of pastors, preachers, talk about how Episcopalians aren't even good Christians and stuff like that. And so I was like, my joke was heard completely different than I ever would have intended it to. And I had no clue. It's like, oh, wow, we're still dealing with that question? Like, I figured that we were past that. But until you understand a culture and a community, like you don't have, you have a word for them, but your word doesn't make as much sense until you understand how they're going to receive it.
That's exactly right. Like, for me, the landmine I had here in Grand Rapids is, you know, we used a tagline in New York and it was church's family, right? Okay. And because you have people moving from all over the world that don't know anybody that are working crazy hours and the church becomes their family, a people that will affirm you, a people that will walk with you, people that will pray with you. That's really helpful in a city where you feel like you're working 80 hours a week in an industry that's sucking your heart dry. So church becomes family. You do Thanksgiving together. If you're in town, you do Christmas. And when you come here and you start giving a vision of the church as family, what people think of is, you know, Uncle Tim, who is really grumpy and that I grew up with, and he's a fundamentalist and is really mean to me, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And so it just, like, the assumptions that people make with certain words, it was such a learning lesson for me of you've got to figure out, like, how these people understand words in a different way. You know, Merritt's book recently was really helpful on that they just mean different things in different places. And so it's been harder for me in Grand Rapids to figure that out.
That's interesting. I grew up, I was born in Philadelphia, lived in Ohio for junior high and high school. And to me, it's like, oh, that seems like an easier culture to figure out, but that's probably just because, you know, I grew up there to some degree. And that Midwest vibe, which I don't know if Grand Rapids would fully identify themselves that way, but it seems Midwest vibe makes sense to me. But that, again, that's because I spent time there. I get it. And you know, every culture is different. And I know Grand Rapids is unique, but Mars Hill has had a peculiar large voice for a small town church. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And obviously people who've been listening to the podcast for a while know Rob's been on maybe a half dozen times. Mm-hmm. Kent was on maybe a year ago or 2 years ago when his book came out. And then Shane Hipps has been on a couple times as well. So we've had a handful of people, I guess basically all the teaching pastors from Mars Hill on. And it's unique that like those three I guess Kent maybe is doing some preaching now, but for the most part, none of them are like full-time pastors at this point. What is it like mm-hmm. stepping into a church where that's kind of the legacy that you're following?
I think the hiring of me was a step in a different direction. Not like one direction was better or worse. I think for me, like I was pretty clear with the leadership on the way in that like, are you hiring me for who I am or some projected idea that you're asking me to live into? And they said the former, that what we're looking for is actually a more formational vision, something like, for instance, what we were rooted in New York in my parish was a very sort of sacramental charismatic expression mm-hmm. that was very faithfully oriented to the past, but also leaning toward the future in terms of the gifts of the Spirit, things of that nature. And so they just said, I think we're ready for that season in our church. And so I've sort of been given license to be myself. And at the same time, I really respect the teaching and the imagination and the reinvention that has come out of Rob. I mean, that guy is I think he's the best communicator of our time. So for me, it's been desiring to live into who I already am. And I am a Jesus person for the sake of the world. So I have a really high commitment to orthodoxy, to sacraments, and to the Holy Spirit. And, you know, where that finds continuity with our past, great. Where it finds discontinuity with our past, so be it. So I think that's how I would describe it.
Yeah. I've had this conversation with Shane before, Shane Hipps, who followed Rob. Or was, I guess they worked together for a while, and then when Rob left, Shane took over the main teaching thing. But when I was in grad school, seminary, I took over for Matt Chandler. And I would say Matt Chandler, who's, you know, a Baptist, Calvinist, Acts 29 yep. guy, him yeah. and Rob, I would say, are probably the two best communicators that I've ever been around. Obviously, they're going to be communicating vastly different directions at this point in their lives, but in terms of just communication, I think they're the two most gifted communicators. And I've joked with Shane about how when I had to take over for Matt, everyone's just like, oh, wait, Matt's not here this week? I literally had one time where we had this reunion service where we had the two previous guys come back. So Matt and the other guy before him, and then myself all preached. And then the following week, I'm in the back of this Baptist church where I'm about to preach. And I have the Garth Brooks microphone on my face, like a clear indicator, like this guy is going to be preaching. And some college student walks up to me and goes, is Matt preaching tonight? And I go, no, he's not. I'm sorry. And she literally turns around and I see her walk out the door. Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to talk. Like, I feel like I have something decent to say. And so early on, it was a real head spinning experience to try to figure out who I was in light of like that big shadow. Luckily for you, you've been doing this a little bit longer. You've been preaching probably 10 years or so. Is that right?
Yeah, about 20. And I think that's the thing with the Protestant sort of ethic, which I consider myself Protestant. So I'm grateful for our tradition and our traditions, I should say. Mm. But the sort of preaching centrality, yep. I think it's one of the things that I long to see the church grow into is a sacramental imagination where, honestly, for me, like one of the first things we did here is we anchored every gathering in the Eucharist mm-hmm. because that is the climax of the service where you remind yourself that if God can move through matter, God can move through me in the rest of the week, that matter matters, that this isn't all just like in our heads. Like we eat this story and we take it into the world and everything is imbued with spirituality. So how do we call out what God is doing in all of the world? And it begins with this wafer. It begins with this meal and this story of Christ. So I think one of my passions in our time and what I encourage pastors is, you know, you get to choose whether you value what she just put on you as to whether that should be heavy for you or whether that's instructive, that I'm not sure that her discipleship has been really formative and helpful if it's reliant on a personality. So bringing in the sacraments, bringing in the ministry of the Holy Spirit to be an experiential place where it's not reliant on who is speaking. One of the things that I got some criticism for when I moved here, other than, you know, the Eucharist, was we took down the list of who is speaking when. and who was going to be up. And these were the days where N.T. Wright would pop in. And I mean, some really heavy hit. Like, I want to raise up some of our staff to teach more. And if their names are on this list, I don't want someone to not show up because someone else on our staff is speaking. That's, to me, that's a very emaciated formation, that you're actually coming for things that aren't actually going to create long-lasting fruit. Yep. And you're only committed to this church until this person leaves and that voice is no longer here or this person moves on. That's not the church for me. Yep. And so that's just been part of what I've wanted to bring here, is a commitment to the person of Jesus, to the reign of the kingdom, and to the Eucharist, and to the gifts of the Spirit. And the fact that the church is a people, not an event, I'll say.
Okay. You've been preaching for 20 years. How old are you?
Yeah, so I'm 16.
You're 16. It's like, my math is not...
30. You're 37? We didn't go for math, man. We would... Theology and math are two different things. Yeah, I'm 37.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm 37 as well. I mean, not because you're 37. I also am 37. That'd be kind of weird if my birthday was correlated on yours. 20 years, good for you. Eucharist. Okay, I'm Church of Christ. I've grown up in a tradition that has celebrated Eucharist every week. Of course, we didn't call it Eucharist. We call it the Lord's Supper. But still, every week, that's central to what we do. So one of the responses is, yeah, I get Lord's Supper is central. It's important. But it's literally only a couple minutes of the service. The sermon is maybe 10 times as long. Communion takes 3 minutes. The sermon is 30 minutes. How do you respond when someone says, I get you want to make Eucharist central, but we're still allocating only a fraction of the time that the sermon takes for Eucharist?
Did I get you right? The time equals value, that's the construct people are working with?
Yeah, I think so.
Like, everything moves toward that moment. Mm-hmm. And time does not necessarily equal a sort of dominant value. Mm-hmm. Everything moves in time to move toward that moment. And I would also say it might be healthy for us preachers to speak less. You know, I'm not sure that a 40 or 50 minute sermon is that needed. I mean, when I hear Will Willimon preach, or when I hear, you know, some of the great Episcopalian preachers, 12 minutes, they can say more in 12 minutes than I can say in 30. You know, it's just incredible the way Barbara Brown Taylor can give a homily and say so much in so little time. So that's been good medicine for me to take. I try to speak under 30 minutes because of that, but I hear what they're saying. I don't know that I would say that time equals value.
But I do agree with the sentiment though, but I don't want to do a 12 minute sermon either. So actually when we had, the Episcopal priest from across the street, he came over and we did a service together. And so we co-preached, and that was his opening joke. He's like, I listened to Luke preach, and man, he did three really good sermons.
Wow.
Each week. Okay. And I was like, that hurts, but you know, whatever. If you want to do that, it's fine. Okay.
But I'll tell you what I'm really passionate about with the Eucharist. People think, well, why do we do this? It's so Catholic and it comes from the Pope. Yeah, it is Catholic in some sense, but it's Jewish and we get it from Moses. Yeah. And it comes through Jesus. Like, the Eucharist is about the most Jewish thing we can do.
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart that people don't understand that we're tapping into our Jewish roots when we take that.
Is that the critique that you've gotten, that this is a Catholic thing, not a Protestant?
That's right. Yeah. Mars was a response to a sort of stuffy high church experience that was pretty like common in Grand Rapids. So you have this new thing, and it sort of became a simplified sort of, we're doing something new that's never been done before, and some really healthy things, but you can sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater if you're not careful, depending on how far you go.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Tell me about your education. Did you do grad school? Where did you do grad school?
I did. I did a couple master's degrees at a conservative reform seminary, and then a liberal reform seminary. And then I did a doctorate at Fuller.
Okay. Seminary. And was your dissertation or something in the Enneagram and preaching or something like that?
Yes. Yes. My dissertation in Fuller was on the Enneagram and how it leads us into a deeper spiritual formation.
Okay. So let's jump in the Enneagram here. How long have you been a student of the Enneagram?
Myself and a couple others were invited to hang out with Richard Rohr for a week around 7-8 years ago.
Okay.
And he started talking about the Enneagram just offhand. And my friend Mark Scandrett was there. And he was like, whoa, let's talk more about that. And so for probably several hours, he started teaching us about the Enneagram. I became obsessed. I attended a workshop with Suzanne Stabile. And I asked Suzanne, like, who's done any formation work out of this? Who's done any spiritual practices and church calendar, biblical narratives based on your number? And she said, nobody. And I was in the middle of discerning my dissertation. And it was at that moment I said, I have got to immerse myself in figuring out how we take this theory and not make it an end, but a means to an end for greater formation.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, I love Rohr. When I first got the Enneagram, I think I was going out to Albuquerque to talk about, I forget which book it was. It was not, what was the last one? It was not The Divine Dance. It was the one before that, I think. But I had gone back and read his book on the Enneagram, and I was like, I need to figure this stuff out. And so I feel like he's been the gateway drug for many of us. And obviously, Suzanne Stabile is one of my dear friends. I love her, and she's been such a great influence.
Yes.
She's outstanding. Let me do the Enneagram guessing game, which I'm not supposed to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. Three? You three? Four wing?
Yes. My wife thinks I'm a 4-3, but I believe I'm a 3-4.
Okay.
Well done.
Well, you know, I'm a professional here. Okay, so Enneagram and spiritual formation. What does this look like in churches? Tell me more about your dissertation.
Yeah, so I wielded it into a workshop because basically what I love for people to walk out of this workshop with is a rule of life.
Okay.
Like, I see the Enneagram as a means, not an end. Mm-hmm. And I think many people are treating it as the goal, is to type yourself or to type others, which isn't a great idea. At least typing others is what I mean by that. That's fine. When you type yourself, it's now an invitation to, like, what I loved about the Enneagram is it really exposes you. Mm-hmm. And it's the humiliation that you get that you can run from, or you can face that shadow and say, how do I become healthy within this? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where spiritual practices matter. So what I wanted to say is that there are spiritual practices that we should attach to numbers so that people can grow toward health within their personality. Yeah. There are biblical narratives that we can find ourselves in the story. I'm not saying David's a 4 or a 3 or whatever. I am saying that there are moments where you can see how David plays this particular type out, where you can begin to relate to the text, not as a history book, but as a book that you can find yourself actually living out the same dramas. Mm-hmm. And in the church calendar, when is that time of the year that I really need to pay attention to? Like for a 7, for example, you said you're a 7. Lent is a really important time of sobriety and taking seriously of being quiet and seeking solitude, because that's a time of year where you're going to discover and reflect rather than, you know, go to your next experience or your next thing or the future orientation that you have. Mm-hmm. That prepares you for Easter Sunday. So I get really interested in the formation of this thing, and I have found that how can we leverage the Enneagram in the church to really help take people into a deeper way of becoming like Jesus?
Yeah, so let's flesh this out some more. So your goal in the workshop is to get people to have a rule of life. Like, isn't this like Benedictine Spirituality 101? Like, right? Is it Benedict who...
Somewhat, yes.
Somewhere in there. Okay, so rule of life, you're developing practices based on your number, your orientation towards the world. So as a 7, I'm going to spend a lot of time on Lent and dealing with my morality or mortality, dealing with, like, I'm going to be sober, I'm going to be right here, I'm not going to jump to the next thing. What are other things that you're thinking as I'm developing a rule of life that I should be focused on or intentional about?
I mean, nouns categories are great. So he helps you set up a construct of solitude, community, and ministry. Mm-hmm. And there are just certain personalities, like 7 moves to community really quickly. It moves away from solitude really quickly. A 4 moves to solitude really quickly and away from community, right? Mm-hmm. So like for me, the first half of the workshop is helping people figure out what their type is.
Yeah.
So in my dissertation, I tried to aggregate the best data, the Helen Palmer, the Don Richard Riso, the Richard Rohr, and I try to take all of their content and put it into a succinct format, so that people can type themselves as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. right? And then the second half of the workshop is then working through, going through back through each type, and it's sort of inviting them to consider what practices might best pair with their typology. Mm-hmm. I think one of the sins of the church that we need to confess as priests and as pastors is that we've basically said something like this. Let's batch spiritual formation, come to a service once a week, maybe go to a small group, maybe give some money, And in 30 years, you'll be different. And I'm not sure that those practices, though they're fine, I like them. I'm not sure that that alone over 30 years leads people to feel different. I think it leads people to just feel older. And so I wanted to say, how do we actually attach spiritual formation within the uniqueness of someone's personality rather than just sort of a batching that often happens in the church? And I think the Enneagram is the way that we can do that.
One of the things that you were intentional to differentiate that the Enneagram is a means, not an end. And some people elevate it to it being the end. It's the totality of what you do. Felina Hewerts was just on this week, and I think she had a nice way of dancing around saying that my type is a two, but I don't want to over-identify as a two. I think that's false self that I want to differentiate from. And so many people are talking about the Enneagram. So many people love the Enneagram. I'm a big fan of the Enneagram. How do we keep that as a tool and not let it become that end?
Yeah, so here's what it is. Your personality is not your identity. Mm-hmm. Your personality is a strategy of coping in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think far too often we are acquiescing to make our personality, when we find our type, that is now who we are. And that can be crushing, especially when we're in unhealth. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the first thing to say is all your personality is something that is both part of your nurture and part of your nature that you strategize to present to the world. It is not your belovedness. Mm-hmm. You are so much deeper than that as a child of God. So that's one of the first things we commit to in this workshop that I do is to take seriously the Enneagram, but don't take it so seriously that it absolutely sort of it capsizes you and it holds you captive to your type. And you know, by the way, you have all parts of these nine faces of the soul within who you are. You just happen to root in one more than others. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the biggest thing is for people to disentangle their identity from their personality.
Yeah.
And to understand that their personality is just a strategy.
Yeah. Personality, I believe the etymology of that word goes back to the Greek word for mask. And personality is this mask that we put on that if we over-identify our mask with who we actually are, then we've lost like our true self.
Nice.
And I think the Enneagram like is this helpful tool because it says this is the mask that you're wearing, but it doesn't like, I think healthy Enneagram teaching always says like, that's not the end of who you are. That's the beauty of the dynamic nature of the Enneagram is that in disintegration or in health and stress and health, we take on different characteristics. But the whole, like you're saying, is that every bit of all nine types reflect the image of God and that some of those are in all of us. And true health is kind of moving away from just where we started, but to where God wants us to go to. And so your critique, I don't know your critique, if that's a fair word, but your question is, does the typical prescription for spirituality of go to church, give a little bit, do the small group, that's not going to help you as ideally as it could? Like there are better spiritual practices than just doing that.
I wouldn't say better. I would just say there's more. There's to Christian spirituality than attending a few functions and giving some money. Like there is a sense of deep inner knowing, mm-hmm. naming some things that are working and not working within the way in which I'm negotiating and navigating life, and that I need to be intentional about seeking practices that are going to help shape me for my home, for my work, and for the world. Mm-hmm. And I think to take practices a little more seriously and discipline is something that's really needed in our time.
So when you're developing a rule of life, which is, you can insert exactly how you would define it yourself, but as I understand it, like these are a list of the practices, the spiritual mm-hmm. disciplines that I need to do that mm-hmm. I think are going to get me where I need to go. As you're developing that, how are you thinking of, this is where I come from, this is my personality, this is who I need to become? How are you picking and choosing the ones that you think are going to connect to someone the best?
Yeah, so what I do is I take you through a list of virtues, both in scripture, Benedictine virtues, cardinal virtues. There's a smattering of virtues throughout the course of human history. And what I want you to do is choose four virtues that you feel like God is inviting you to now start to take seriously this season. For example, that might be the virtue of purity. It might be the virtue of generosity. It might be the virtue in our political moment of kindness and patience and self-control. And so what I want you to do is choose four of those virtues. And I want you to think about practices that are going to connect you with each virtue that could help you develop a sense Like, for example, there is no greater virtue to develop patience for me than centering prayer. Like, to just sit and be with God and to have a sacred word where you're not performing anything, you're not trying to get anything out of it, you're just being, is really important. For me, the virtue of mission can get left off of my busy life. So every week I have in my calendar a time where I am using my hands and I'm serving downtown in a particular organization that has nothing to do with my job. Because if I'm not careful, I will omit serving the poor and I'll read books instead. And so it's these ways of like figuring out, okay, what is beyond me? What is the next transcendent sort of way in which I'm being called into? How could I name that in a virtue? And then how can I create practices that are going to guide me into that virtue? And then how can I create a habit that then makes that normalized in my life so that I can reflect over the course of time?
Yeah. I think that sort of intentionality about knowing our own propensities and proclivities to like you, I'd rather read a book than to, you know, serve the poor. Like it'd be far easier for me just to do that.
Yes.
A level of intentionality of naming those things, of acknowledging that this certain way of life is not getting me to where God probably wants me to go. I think it's a very helpful thing for all of us to do. When you're prescribing, you're helping people walk through this, what's been some of the feedback as people are thinking of, well, I've never really developed a rule of life. What's the feedback? Is this like a refreshing thing? Is this like seem overwhelming? Does it come across as too authoritarian? Like these are things that you need to do?
Sure. No, it's liberating, and I'll tell you why. People can take responsibility for their future, right? So basically what I'm saying to you in the workshop is you decide who you're becoming. You get to choose what your heart veers to in your future. You get to choose what your loves are. And we live in a culture where so much is put on us, and in many ways we're tragic victims of so much that has happened to us in our childhood. So what I'm saying to you that I get you're a tragic victim. I get there's been a lot of things that have happened to you that you did not want. However, I also believe this is an invitation for you to reinvent your story and to figure out who it is that you want to be and to disrupt the cycle of those things happening by creating who God's calling you to be.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I love it as an invitation, like, and to understand that we all are not the enemy and I think there's some ownership, like that. There are some of the issues that I have that I am fully responsible for that I need to own up to. But to acknowledge that there are struggles that we've all inherited that we're trying to overcome, that we're trying to make peace of. And I think there needs to be some grace that we all need to receive. So yep. I like it. Okay, so you've been doing these conferences for a while now?
A couple years, yeah.
Yeah. And what is it? Do you ever preach on the Enneagram? Does it ever work its way into your sermons?
No, it's one of my rules that I start with at the workshop is do not become the Enneagram church. Because what happens is you create an insider-outsider language.
Yeah.
And I don't want people stepping into Mars Hill thinking that they need to know some secret coded Enneagram language to belong here.
Yeah.
So it is a very real rarity that anything comes up on a Sunday with the Enneagram.
Mm-hmm. Have you done the sermon series, the nine different ways of seeing the world without calling it the Enneagram, but you're kind of preaching the Enneagram?
No. Honestly, it's so funny. I told Elena, my wife, this the other day, I talk about the Enneagram so little outside of my workshops. It's so weird. Hmm. For something to have been such a big part of my life, I don't talk about it unless people ask about it. It's weird. And I don't have any struggles like typing people. I don't care to do that. It's just never been, it's sort of like a real grace. It's just not like it's so helpful for me. It's just not become the center of my being. And yet I sort of see through that lens without naming it. And I feel like I have a really healthy relationship with theory.
Hmm. That's good. So you haven't typed your daughter yet?
That's impossible. Of course I've typed my daughter, but it's, discover. It's not for me to name, yeah. Which is another one of our rules as we go through the workshop is do not type other people because it really, it's their journey. It's beautiful. Suzanne taught me that.
Yeah.
It's their journey to name. It's beautiful for them to be on that journey and discover.
Mm-hmm. So our daughters have heard us talk about the Enneagram enough. And Lindsay and I, we're actually, I think, I don't know if she's announced it or not yet, but Suzanne's going to do a like a live podcast about Enneagram and parenting. And so Lindsay and I are going to be on a panel with a couple other families. And so we're talking about the other night at the dinner table. And Avery goes, "What number do you think I am?" She's 10. She's heard us talk that she thinks she knows. And so I don't say the numbers, but I walk through and describe, well, you know, and an 8 is, you know, the challenger, and then, you know, the 9 is a peacemaker. And I walk through them, and my daughters, like, their faces come alive at the numbers that I think that they're going to gravitate towards as they grow up. But of course, I won't let them ever know which one they are.
Well, they say at age 4 is that's when a parent can really start to discern a few types. And that at 20 is their purest personality.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think I affirm whoever came up with that. Those two things have sort of worked for me as I've worked longer in the theory.
So 4, huh? So here's a weird thing. I had Roar, we did a Facebook Live, and I had someone from my church ask a question. What about this in teenagers? And he says, yeah, you don't talk to any kid, like, you don't talk to anyone under the age of 20 about the Enneagram. They're too young to know it. And so I've heard that perspective. And then I've also heard, like, some people have books about Enneagram and raising your kids and what number they are. And I don't know what the right thing is. I'm not an expert on it, but I definitely feel like I know what 2 out of my 3 daughters are. That's all. So anyway, well, AJ, I feel like I've atoned for my transgressions on that fated flight into New York a few weeks back. I feel like we can move forward as friends now.
I receive your fade into my life.
And that means a lot to me. And I'm going to pass that on to my therapist, and she'll appreciate your acknowledgement of the work that she has done, even though I haven't got a haircut since then because I'm growing the hair out. But that's neither here nor there. AJ, all the best. Merry Christmas. I think I'm going to put this one out before Christmas. So how about this? Give us a Christmas blessing for my listeners here.
You got it. Yeah, may the Lord, as you grow in simplicity and humility, may you see the Christ child amongst you, and that God's reign is here even when we do not see, that God works mysteries in the dark, and may we run with that the rest of our lives. Amen.
There it is, guys. AJ, it's been a pleasure.
Grace and peace.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.